My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here with Chip Childers of the Cloud Foundry Foundation.
As you said, Chip Childers, Chief Technology Officer for the Cloud Foundry Foundation. The Cloud Foundry Foundation is the industry association that stewards the open source Cloud Foundry platform and the software, as well as working with the ecosystem, right? So we deal with both the technology and the open source of it. We also deal with helping the collaboration, helping companies do business with each other. We focus on being the nexus of that ecosystem and finding ways to help everyone elevate each other.
One of the challenges for open source is trust. We saw a lot of trust break down over what happened with OpenSSL. We hear a lot from the communities about, oh, lots of eyeballs on the code. It will make the code better. But that's not true of 95% of projects that die very quickly over a period of time. How do you build a community? How do you talk to enterprises and companies about why they can trust what you're doing?
Oh, I think that's a great question. First of all, let's talk about the 90% of projects that basically go nowhere. Open source is really two things. One, it's a licensing model, which means nothing. It doesn't mean you can trust it. Just because it's possible for eyeballs to be on the lines of code doesn't mean that it's in use, and it doesn't mean that it's actually has eyeballs on it. So let's just exclude that and instead focus on those open source efforts that are seeing material traction in terms of use. They're seeing community growth in terms of contribution. And I think here's one of the most important parts. One of the things that makes enterprise software that's open source really go is that it's a little bit different than the open source software that's about scratching your own itch as an individual developer. That still happens, and we love that, but it's not the driving force behind software that deals with, you know, platform level concerns. In reality, there are economic cycles that need to exist. Vendors continue to be the predominant contributors to this type of software, technology vendors. Those vendors need to be compensated somehow for the investment they're making, and so they need customers. The way that trust works with Cloud Foundry in particular is that, one, we have a very healthy vendor ecosystem. Two, we have a exponentially healthy set of end customers of those vendors. What that causes, it causes the virtuous cycle of feedback moving through the system. And I could say a lot of other projects are like that. But I'd say in addition to them, the way that we've thought about what we call our platform certification program is actually really material to this notion of trust. When we have a what we call a certified distribution of Cloud Foundry, it means they're using the software as released by the open source project in an unmodified form. They have the right to go modify it, but because we're really focused on that trust, we want to make sure that any issues that they identify as a vendor who's dealing with customers and is contractually obligated to support those customers, oftentimes they have to fit into regulatory frameworks. All of the security posture improvements that they're making need to flow to the upstream. It's a little bit of a hack. We're licensed as Apache License Version 2, which is super permissive. You can do anything you want, and there's a lot of great experimentation that happens. There are also platforms that are not certified for many reasons. They might choose to modify in certain ways. But we have a critical mass of the certified distribution, who in turn have a critical mass of end customers, and it creates this wonderful cycle of ensuring that the security concerns are being dealt with.
Now, you're in a very different position to a lot of companies doing this. They tend to be a company, it's found an open source project, and it says, okay, we'll do an enterprise version. We'll be maybe three or four versions behind what the community's doing, because that gives us time to harden the code and everything else. You actually sit between those companies doing that and the community. I'm just a single company with a community. I can easily make sure my changes flow back. When you've got what is now seven distributions out there and people further downstream, it becomes slightly harder, does it not, to prove trust to the community in that all those changes and stuff that go on out there are really coming back to you.
The way you can think about change and evolution of the platform is really two things. One of them is going to be reactive. Reactive issues are those that are security vulnerabilities that exist that are identified, number one. Could also be performance issues that are found in large scale because we have, for example, IBM Bluemix runs one of the largest deployments of Cloud Foundry across the globe. So they hit scaling concerns that maybe the typical enterprise user, like the Home Depot, they're using it very heavily, but they're not at the same scale that IBM is as a shared service provider. Reactive issues are naturally fed back, and we've designed for not only a vulnerability reporting process, but also a feedback loop that gets it back. And our cert program allows them to modify immediately to protect themselves, but then we go through an audit process. The other part of what we mean by the evolution of the software really has to do with the feature development and architectural evolution. We're not in a tight reaction cycle to what's happening in the distributions. the distributions need to collaborate in the upstream to move the features forward, to move the architecture forward. And so that's where that type of forward-looking development occurs.
The vulnerability system that you've built is quite clever because it allows you to find all sorts of issues, but make sure that people look at them, make sure they address them. And of course, this is a major concern for companies. By the time they generally find out about a vulnerability, it's way too late. And that's because for commercial organizations, there's a need to keep that quiet while they work out what the issue is, work out a fix, and then announce. You react much quicker, you make the information available much quicker. How hard was it getting buy-in from everybody in having that faster exposure rate?
The interesting thing is that the commercial distributions of Cloud Foundry generally are signing up for service level agreements that apply to their ability to respond to a known vulnerability or threat. It's funny, we're talking about software, but I frequently go to like, how's the market work? Because the way the market works is the way frequently the community is going to actually work. And because these companies have these contractual obligations to be responsive, they collaborate on our vulnerability management process as a collective. They all feedback into the collective. It knows how to triage, hand it out to the project teams. The open source community is not public about known security vulnerabilities until they've been remediated and been kicked back out in a release, which is a pretty common practice for any open source project. But it's a multi-vendor activity to do that. It's multiple participants from multiple vendors, and then the right project teams are told about it. That's a really important kind of way to think about the vulnerability management process. The other thing that's maybe a little bit more unique for Cloud Foundry is the total size of the tree of open source that we pull together. We're not just about the code that our community writes, but we include, for example, when I think about what does our code base include, it includes the entire Node.js framework, Java, the JRE, Spring. You name a language and a framework that a developer that wants to work on a platform like Cloud Foundry wants to work on, that's actually part of our upstream. As an upstream open source community, we have an enormous set of upstream communities above us. The way that the Cloud Foundry community is operating for dealing with, for example, we have two artifacts that we released that are based on Canonical's Ubuntu operating system. One of them is called the Bosch Stem Cell underlying operating system. And then we have this thing called the root FS, or the root file system, that all of our container activity gets layered on top of. Both of those include libraries that are open source software that Ubuntu has a process for, you know, managing all the CVEs, and they have upstreams. As the open source community, we can't guarantee delivery of new versions whenever a critical or high vulnerability comes up, but I can observe that the commercial obligations of our vendors mean that they're participating in the upstream and are executing on a sub 48-hour response time. Because Cloud Foundry deployments everywhere can take advantage of the stem cell shared root file system, we see fixes to vulnerabilities propagate through our ecosystem extremely fast. Some of our vendors are even looking at what does it mean to be not just a software vendor, but to deliver software continuously. How do you actually attach the customer environment where they owned it, they install it, how do you attach that to the upstream pipelines so that when the productization pipelines or the upstream communities pipelines complete, then a bunch of productization pipelines at each one of our vendors kick in. And then behind that, you have customer environments running pipelines that are watching for a new release, and they suck it in and deploy it.
So how difficult is that for you to manage? Because you're effectively playing ringmaster here, but without a commercial stake in the game. It's not like you're taking large sums of money off of everybody down the line. You don't get any money when a distro sells out to a customer. You're having to fund from the membership fees and handle what's an incredibly complicated set of problems here.
Remember that the engineering work itself isn't something that the foundation pays for. Membership fees are about supporting the operation of the organization. They're about, frankly, supporting the development of a shared market. So the marketing that we do, this event that we're running, it takes money. It's naive to talk about open source communities not needing funding to market themselves, to understand, to grow. That's where that funding really goes. All of the engineering work comes out of our member companies. They assign their engineers into these projects. And so that's how that works. Our job is to make sure that they're able to efficiently collaborate, because we talked about vulnerabilities and how quickly things need to flow out through the ecosystem. We also spend a lot of time dealing with the tougher situations where not just difference of opinions, but even conflicting market goals could certainly cause tension and pull. We've got a very clear governance process that's designed for handling decision making that's in place that works very well. Just as important, though, is the softer side of the governance. Really, the softer side is more about making sure that people have the space to collaborate and communicate. And we prize empathy in this community. empathy for not just your fellow individuals that may or may not work for the same company as you, but actually empathy between the companies to understand what's their market position, what are their customers looking for. Best example of that I'll give you, and I'm going to name company names here because I think it's important. One of our core projects inside the Cloud Foundry application runtime is what's called Diego. It's the, I hate to call it just a container scheduler, but it's very purpose-built for the PaaS experience container scheduler. We were in a transition from it as the new architecture from an older architecture. It was feature complete at a point where one of the companies, Pivotal, would have met all of their commercial goals. They happened to have the majority of the developers on that project. Not all of them, but the majority. And so they had the voting right to say, okay, we're going to just archive all of the older architecture. But they knew that IBM, running one of the largest deployments, needed to actually ensure that the new architecture could hit the scale that they needed. These two companies, while they do compete in the market, their development teams and the product managers involved were extremely comfortable with the idea that the best thing for the collective is to ensure that before we begin the migration process, we spend the time to get the scalability up. It was actually a 12-month cycle that we went through. The first 6 months were focusing on performance and scale in order to achieve what was IBM's milestone target. Once that was achieved, then they declared 1.0 for Diego, and they declared the beginning of the end of life cycle for the older architecture, which was a 6-month cycle. The overwhelming majority of end customers, direct open source users, everyone could have begun the transition 12 months before we finally said, okay, we're moving the old architecture to read-only. So it's a great example of we all had to navigate the market dynamics, the competition, and then understand what was best for the whole movement.
One of your other challenges is making sure that the distros all align, so you've got a certification process in place. One of the problems that we have at the moment that we're getting close to solving is the service broker, which is why we don't have an app marketplace at the moment, because it's not possible to certify an app and know that it would run on all the distros. It's also part of the migration challenge for a customer who might be on one distro and look to go to another. They can stay within the core elements, but actually with some of the distros, it's very hard to see sometimes what's purely core and what's the extra bits they've added on. How do you see that evolving over the next year? Will the service broker be in a state within a year where we can start to see a proper app marketplace evolve?
Maybe the problem with the question that you're asking is that the design of the service broker API is such that how the service on the back end is going to be delivered to the user, it's not defined. It's purposefully not defined, because I'll dive into how the Open Service Broker API itself is evolving in a second, but there are use cases that are simple as, I've got an existing Oracle database that I run my business off of, and I'd like my web applications that are being deployed in Cloud Foundry to talk to it. So you stub out a service broker interface that can pass out credentials to the new apps that are being spun up for a web front end. The API itself has no ability, and it should not have an ability, to specify how that backing service is being delivered. The closest thing that I think that we're going to get to is where we're headed right now, which is that by making this API as pervasive as possible, we're going to begin to see a continued and hopefully more exponential growth in the number of backing services that are being made available. So we made a bet a while ago, which was that we saw that Google was interested in the API and how they could use it for their cloud services. We saw that there was OpenDAIS, it was a maybe competitive PaaS software package. They had in their roadmap, we're going to implement the Cloud Foundry Service Broker API. So we stepped back and said, well, what might actually be the most interesting thing for the whole industry would be to say, we want to find a way to change the governance so it's not directly tied to Cloud Foundry, the platform, but it's actually open and more so than just the Cloud Foundry constituency, and in particular the Kubernetes community, as well as public cloud service providers. They were kind of the two targets. If you've been watching Kubernetes and some of the activity happening there, I'll point to Red Hat. Red Hat has the OpenShift platform. It absolutely competes with our commercial distributions. They consider it competitive to it, and we're really happy to see that now Red Hat is investing in implementing services using the Open Service Broker API. They've used that to build the Red Hat Marketplace. But now, for example, Red Hat owns Ansible. There's an Ansible Service Broker that opens up a world of recipes that have been built in the Ansible community. You can use those too if you're using a Cloud Foundry environment. By making that API more pervasive, we were going to create a lot more fluidity in how different ISVs can package their software. It might not be the ideal that you're hinting at in your original question, but the practicality of actually allowing some of that flexibility, I think, balanced with multiple ecosystems coming together, working together. You see Microsoft, you see Google, both embracing it and both using their implementation to expose all of their great cloud services to anyone who wants to consume them.
And that delivers on the promise that open source has been giving us, isn't it, for 20 years, where you don't really care about vendor locking because it won't happen. There'll be a way to work with any of the vendors you want and any of the software you want because it will begin to interoperate, but interoperate in a standardized fashion that everybody can commit to rather than you're buying into something owned by a vendor where you're a hostage to their fortune.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You always get locked into technology. Anybody who tells you otherwise is lying to you. Because we have to make choices, and choices are about trade-offs. And the trade-offs that you want to make, especially if you're an organization and you're going to invest heavily in that choice, you need to make a choice that says, well, I might not have perfect portability. I might not have perfect vendor equality where I can just do arbitrage between them based purely on price. But do I have enough that I have the flexibility that I need? Is it derived from open source in a way that's usably portable between the systems? And in this case, the main target is like the ISV market. So as an ISV who wants to offer services, using this API becomes, that's their portability because they can target Kubernetes users, they can target Cloud Foundry application runtime users, they can target OpenShift users. It becomes a lot more flexible for them.
If we look forward over the next year, cloud service broker is one thing we know we're working a lot harder on. What else can we expect to see? And I appreciate that you're driven more by the community who give you the technology, but what's your focus?
This morning we announced that we were changing some names and we were realigning the way that we're explaining the various capabilities of Cloud Foundry. The reason that we're doing that is not just to change names, it's actually to reflect what is a massive wave of desire within our end user community, then naturally borne out in the vendor part of the ecosystem, to really elevate the container as a service abstraction, to bring it up to parity with the platform as a service abstraction, where you just push your code into the platform as a service, it deals with the containers for you. But there are a lot of use cases where you want container-based workloads to just land into a platform. Kubernetes is absolutely the market leader in that space, but there were some gaps. So our container runtime was originally a partnership between Pivotal and Google. Now VMware engineers are involved. We also have Swisscom announced today that they're going to start getting involved. We're going to continue to see more involvement from our vendor ecosystem. What they're really working towards is the customer demand to be able to say, I want to write all my custom applications using the PaaS. I want to be able to attach them to backing services. Some of those backing services are going to be newer breed, born for containers databases. There are a lot of databases that I would be very hard-pressed to recommend someone try to run on Kubernetes, quite frankly. It's possible, technically, but might not be the best choice. So we want to make sure there's the choice. You could use Cloud Foundry Bosch to manage stateful services that are VM-centric. Cloud Foundry Bosch now deploys the container runtime, which is Kubernetes. It lets a developer ask for a Kubernetes cluster on demand, but it also presents an opportunity for backing services to exist and expose themselves via service broker API endpoints back to that application developer. There's also, again, I go to ISVs. You know, the other format for ISVs that want to ship software as opposed to deliver it as a service, more and more they're being shipped as OCI image format, and that's a great thing. And so we want to be able to land those easily and have all the same operational benefit. You know, we have ratios, operational benefits of one operator to thousands of developers. That is a normal Cloud Foundry operational story, which is the right type of ratio to have.
Sounds like you've got a fairly manic year ahead of you.
Every year has been manic since January of 2015 when the foundation was originally created. I think maybe manic's the wrong word. I would say exciting. There's always more opportunity. We have an extremely active community. We are one of the largest open source communities on the planet today. We have intense and amazing end user stories and end customers that are really changing their businesses. So it's a very exciting time.
Chip, thank you for your time today.
This was great. Thank you.